Memoirs of Suicide.
How did she leave us in this brutal way? You know, people sometimes say when they read this book, they can't put it down. And I think it's because there's this momentum of trying to come to some kind of peace or resolution where I can lay my mother to rest and move forward.
That's Nancy Rappaport. We talk with her about her memoir, In Her Wake. It's about her mother's suicide, how it affected her family, and how she came to terms with her loss.
You know, it's called The Suicide Index. It's about my father's suicide, but it's also about family relationships. And, you know, an event happened in my family that was a huge event that put pressure on all the pressure points that were already there in the family.
And that's Joan Wickersham. We talk with her about her 2008 memoir of her father's suicide, The Suicide Index. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 1963, Nancy Rappaport's mother killed herself after a bitter divorce and custody battle. Rappaport was 4 years old at the time. As one of 11 children in a prominent Boston family, she struggled to come to terms with the reasons why her mother took her own life. Her memoir, In Her Wake, is a profoundly moving exploration of her mother's death and its aftermath. Rappaport spent 18 years interviewing family and friends, persisting despite opposition from some family members, including her father, and went to court records and even an unpublished novel by her mother to evolve her own understanding of her mother and why she took her life. Rappaport uncovers the story of a conflicted and troubled activist, socialite, and community leader, who was also a warm and loving mother who adored her children. Nancy Rappaport is a child psychiatrist who practices in the Boston area. She draws thoughtful lessons from her own story that can help other families deal with the trauma of suicide and also help prevent it. I started our conversation by asking Nancy Rappaport to read an excerpt from In Her Wake.
The day my mother killed herself, she had just finished preparing her house on Marlborough Street for the anticipated return of her children after a fierce custody battle with my father. There were six of us and much to do. I was her youngest child, barely 4 years old. It was a house expecting people, 14 rooms and 5.5 baths in a turn-of-the-century townhouse on a tree-lined street near the Boston Public Garden, where my mother lived with her new husband, Alex. On this high-stakes day in September of 1963, Massachusetts Supreme Court Justice Whittemore considered my father's appeal to keep custody of his children and stayed our anticipated return until the appeal could be heard. We would not be coming home to my mother after all. My mother and the new husband she had married a few months before would be the only people to fill these rooms. I imagine that when my mother heard Judge Whittemore's decision, cold dread must have overcome her. In my mind, she was white as powder, her body slack and weighted down, stumbling from one room to the next, overwhelmed by the vacancy. It is family lore that I am the last person my mother saw before she killed herself. She drove to my father's house pleading to see the children, but I was the only child at home. My father demanded that she leave. B, our housekeeper, hustled me out the door and down the driveway toward my mother, who waited desolate on the street. She bent down and caressed my hair. I remember as she whispered instructions to B to watch over us, especially me. And then she left. She left a suicide note as well as a grocery list, a list in preparation for our arrival that would never happen. 6 tangerines, 2 boxes of Kleenex, pink is crossed out and replaced by blue, sugar-free root beer, blue toilet paper, 4 pounds rump roast, lettuce, tomatoes, food for a family.
It's such a tragic setting that you give us here, and tragic, too, the sense that this really didn't have to go that way, that this was, in some ways, a very impulsive act.
Well, that's definitely the take-home message of the book, is that when those of us who are left with someone who has killed themselves, often there is mental illness, substance abuse, a profound sense of hopelessness, and key is impulsivity. And that's probably my drive as a child psychiatrist and as a writer trying to tell a compelling story is to capture the tragedy of it. And for anybody who is suicidal, who's lost someone in this way, for them to come deeply to understand how it unfolds and to hope that people will pause long enough to be reminded that they're not expendable.
Your book is really a rich story because you combine your own experience as a child psychiatrist with your years-long exploration of what happened with your mother. How long did it take?
Well, I know some of my family members would be wishing that I had, you know, wrapped it up in a nice ribbon faster, but it took me 18 years, and I would always say, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, was it a cathartic experience to write this book? And I would say in the first 4 years, it certainly was cathartic, and then it really became more of a drive to try to figure out how can I tell the story in a way that draws in the reader to care about my mother and want to know more about how we deal with loss in our lives and move forward in a way that's healing.
Now, I'm going to go back. You've already laid out the day that she killed herself. I wonder if you remember, what do you remember about when you first heard of what happened? Do you remember anything of your reaction?
You know, I've been asked that before, and I wish I had a crisp memory, but I also know from working with children that that's not the way a lot of kids operate, particularly around something traumatic. But in the process of writing this, what I came across was a short story that I had written when I was in fourth grade, and I'd kept it in my bookshelf for years, and I reread the story, and it was as if it was a snapshot of my unconscious, and in it, it was a story about a chimp and baboon, which is how kids work. They work in displacement, but it was about a story of the mother killing herself, and what I came across from that, and probably why it took me as long to write the book, is even at that point, which it didn't reemerge until I had my first child, was a sense that this mama baboon loved her child. And that is something that I came to appreciate when I had my first child, which is when I started to write this story. And also there was a sense of someone having been done wrong. And that was the important part of me writing this story, because often in a suicide demands an explanation, and you look at the story to see, especially I think as a child, that you feel responsible and you want to make a narrative that helps you understand it. And that was very important for me to come to an adult understanding of how complicated this loss was.
And you do, not only complicated within your own mind, but also, as you refer to it, the Rashomon-like, you know, different stories, the different angles on the story that you got from so many people. Why don't you start out by let our listeners know what was going on. There were six children.
There were six children. I was the youngest of the six, and my mother had made a suicide attempt 2 years before and had had an affair with her campaign manager for school committee back in 1963, and she lost custody to her children. She had a two-year custody battle with my dad, thought she was going to be getting the children back, and when that got stayed, she killed herself. And that's the contours of it. The twists and turns in me telling the story were that I was sort of like a detective trying to unravel the mystery. And in suicides, they have this sort of fancy term, but it's called psychological autopsy, where you interview friends, family. And I took that on my own personal odyssey, where I interviewed people that knew my mother, including her best friends, my dad, my siblings. And then while I was writing this, my mother's best friend had kept a trunk at the time that was given to her at the time of my mother's death, and I got it 40 years later. And in that trunk were a treasure trove of resources that were helpful in me coming to a deeper understanding of who my mother was. And there was a novel that my mother was writing at the time of her death called The End of Freedom. There were photographs of the kids, and I had really grown up with none of this richness.
And your mother was a very loving and very involved mother with her kids.
That's the heartbreak of it. When I got in the trunk, one of the things was a letter called Problems of a Long-Distance Mother. And being a child psychiatrist and reading that, and then being a daughter and a mother of three kids, that was probably one of the more painful moments for me, because she had such a close scrutiny and expectation of what she wanted to be as a mother. And yet I was left with, and that was the compelling part. Sometimes George Orwell talks about, you know, why we write in the North Star of our existence, how you have to have something that you're passionate about. And I was trying to understand if my mother loved us, and I came to appreciate that she did, and that's important. That was very important to me as an emerging mother. How did she leave us in this brutal way? So, you know, people sometimes say when they read this book, they can't put it down, and I think it's because there's this momentum of trying to come to some kind of peace or resolution where I can lay my mother to rest and move forward.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with psychiatrist Nancy Rappaport about her memoir of her mother's suicide, In Her Wake. The book is brutally honest, not least with yourself, I have to say.
I'm glad I didn't let myself off the hook.
Not at all. And what really comes to me is, and we haven't talked about your father yet, which I'd like to do right after this, but what really comes to me is that both your parents were very, very committed to being good parents, and they were both very, very flawed people. And I don't think that's something most of us kind of put together in the same sentence.
Well, and hopefully if we do put that together, we also, if we're our parents ourselves, have a level of understanding and forgiveness, because I have my own flaws as parenting. And some of what I was trying to do was to have a level of compassion for both of my parents. And that when in my work as a child psychiatrist, I know that what I appeal to is the best side of ourselves as parents. And so, you know, my dad is 82. He's still alive, and he's been a strong, loving parent to me for, you know, 46 years after my mother killed herself. I'm now 50. And this was this was probably a story he would have preferred for me to leave alone. And yet I felt that it was so important, if this story allows other people to gain an understanding about their life, that was my drive to tell it.
In fact, he was quite angry at you, and you were even estranged for a while you were writing this.
For a short period of time. But as the last chapter speaks about, we came together in a way, and again, I'm trying to model, what do you do when you have, as a daughter, as a father, you have profoundly different understandings of an experience that happened 45 years ago. And as he would say, I was only 4 years old, and there was a certain amount of indignation. How dare I tell a story, particularly, you know, but that's what happens in the nature of telling a story. It's my, you know, not to diminish it, but it's my best effort to tell the truth and to tell a personal fable. If my father wrote it, it would be a different book. If my older sister had, it would be a different story. But that's what I tried to bring a certain level of understanding. And, the concern always is that when you print something, there's a level of immortality about it. And what I would have written 15 years ago is a very different book than what I learned through the process of discovery.
Really? How would it have been different?
Oh, when I, and certainly there were many copies of this book you know, drafts before it became it, it was much more raw, and it was much more demanding into the void of the absence of my mother, an explanation, and wanting her to be present to her grandchildren, my children, showing me the way of being a mother. And it softened over the years, and I gave more room for the multi-layered understanding.
Your father, you know, you say it's your best attempt at the truth, and you went to great lengths to get everybody's story.
Yes, exhausting.
Yeah, and I think that might be one of the things that could be problematic for your father, because as good a man as he ultimately is shown to be, you know, he had some pretty serious flaws. He was violent toward your mother, at least that's the implication, at a certain point. I mean, this was right around the time of the custody battle, but he got violent, and it was in front of the kids. Their fights were something that, you know, you're not supposed to do in front of kids. I would imagine the truth is what could have hurt him. And then how was it for you to expose him?
Well, you're asking, you know, very penetrating questions, and you know, what I would say is that I don't want to demonize anyone in the book, and that I try to tell the story not shying away from some of the aspects that are difficult. And, you know, this was 1963, and I don't justify actions, but I also know that, you know, my father grew a lot in 45 years.
Yeah. That must have been painful, though.
Yes.
But
it's important also. I just want to underline that I have a deep love for my father, and that hopefully comes across in the book. And many children that I've worked with who have had sometimes things happen that they wish might not have happened with their parents carry both loyalty and sometimes a wish that things could have been different.
Well, I think that is, in fact, the richness of your book, is that there are no villains. There are, in some ways, they're all heroes, in spite of their flaws.
I'm happy to hear you say that, because that's certainly also, when you look at children of suicide, one of the important things that you see is that how well a child does or how well a family does often is around their surviving parent and the kind of guidance that they can provide and stability. And that was something that my father did.
Yeah. Well, so tell us about your dad.
Well, he's a man with a certain sense of humor and very intelligent. And, you know, we have a huge family at this point. We have 13 family members because my dad's been remarried twice. And he has a remarkable capacity to make each one of us feel special. And, you know, that's a certain gift, I know, just with having three children. So,
and tell us a bit about the social background of your parents, because that enters into it as well. You mentioned already that your mother was running for the school
committee. Yeah.
In fact, and she was ultimately, she dropped out, as I remember. And,
right.
And Louise Day Hicks, who was the one who spearheaded the whole Boston anti-integration campaign, was the person who won. Your parents were much more liberal than Louise Day Hicks.
Right. Oh, definitely. I mean, if there was anything selfish, I wish my mother had stuck around so she could have given Louise Day Hicks a good fight. But she withdrew after she had the affair with her campaign manager. It was clear that she couldn't run. But the way I would describe my parents at that time is my dad had been involved with trying to oust Curley, who was a beloved mayor but somewhat corrupt in Boston, and then had gotten involved with what the Globe usually says is a controversial development, the West End, which was a development in Boston. But both of them were prominent, and that was part of the unveiling for me. Often in suicide, it's referred to as silent grief, where you don't talk about it a lot in families. And in the context for me, my sister Judy and I had looked at articles that had been written about the divorce and the custody battle back in 1961 to 1963, and then the, you know, death of my mother. And that was a fairly polarized view of what was going on with my family, and pretty bleak looking. And some of the details that you referred to were referenced in those articles. And I start the book with these articles because that was how I understood it. And then I was on a quest to make it more deep than just what a newspaper would present.
And more nuanced.
Yes, exactly, nuanced.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking with Nancy Rapoport. Her book is In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. Now, it was a very complicated web of relationships that led to the breakup, in actual fact. I mean, you mentioned that your mother had an affair with her campaign manager. Your father married your mother's lover's ex-wife.
Yes, you did that so well. You should say that for the your mother's lover's ex-wife. And you're right. There's a twist in that that was, I would imagine, pretty painful for my mother. At the time of her death, she had remarried a different man than her campaign manager. And I was raised where that was just sort of the reality, that this kind of thing happens, that people remarry in this kind of changed musical chairs. And it wasn't until I actually started to write the book that I realized that that had a sort of novel twist to it. And again, the generosity of some of the main characters that were, not to distance myself from it, because, but, you know, for my father, for my mother's lover, for my stepmom, my first stepmom, Barbara, to allow these interviews and allow me to come back and ask those kind of questions was very generous and gave me, as you said, a more nuanced look at what happened to my mother and who she was.
Why do you think they were so generous? And I'm thinking particularly of your talks with Barbara. I mean, she comes across as very refreshingly frank, able to take in criticism or difficult things that you show her, and to come back with a fair amount of aplomb. Why do you think that they were so open with you?
That will remain a mystery, but something I will forever be grateful about. And certainly with Barbara, when you talk about me being honest with myself, this was a woman who I really had not had be intimately involved with my immediate family. And I come back and ask her to talk with me in a way, revisiting a time of life where she had 11 children that were from 5 to 17 years old, and tell me more about my mother. And in some ways, that's the other thing, though, that I want to inspire the reader, is oftentimes people will say, well, how do you go about asking questions with things that happened so many years ago? And that's partly, you know, my training as being a child psychiatrist, but it's also something that all of us can do. We may be raised with certain truths, or raised with an absent parent, whether it's an alcoholic parent or a parent that had a mental illness that wasn't as available. And being, some of it I'm saying, we can have the courage, and sometimes it does take courage, to go back and ask questions so that we can begin to challenge the way that we may have understood things as we were being raised.
Barbara was the woman that your father married, that he was dating when the custody battle was going on. And as you say, she was your stepmother, your first stepmother. One gets a sense also of the, I'm not sure of the word that came to me is fluidity, but I think it's more than that, of the change, of how relationships can change, because while you were growing up with her, she was not an easy person to get along with, and you were not all that happy with her.
So you have such a nice way of having aerial views of my book, which is one of the things I've loved, is how people see different things. Because I wouldn't have appreciated that that's one of the things I'm highlighting, is the fluidity of relationships. But as you say it, I say there's a fluidity of relationships that's going on in multiple places throughout the book. the relationship with my mother, that at the beginning, as a newborn mom myself, I'm angry at her and have a sense of betrayal. And then there, as I evolve and find out more of her, there becomes a continuous bond with her where I could say now I feel her presence in my life in a way that feels full and nuanced. And then with my dad, there were times in my life where I might have wrestled with, you know, blaming him, quite frankly, for things that he might not have deserved the kind of blame that I was willing to dole out, and then came to an appreciation of what I hold so importantly as a child psychiatrist, which is that you don't allow the child to define the relationship, and that when a daughter may push you away, that you, you know, allow yourself to make overtures and remain present in their life. And then with my, you know, stepmother, I learned another quality of where I could feel very self-righteous as a, you know, in my 20s about her, and then come to have a level of humility about what she was managing 26 years old with 9 children under 12, 6 of them who'd had a mother who killed herself, and then going on to have 2 more children. So that's also what the story is about, is that sometimes as people we can be judgmental and self-righteous. And when you say I'm hard on myself, or I think you said honest with myself, it's pushing myself to expand how we look at who we are and who we are in relation to other people.
You just said that in a family where a child is threatening to cut off a relationship with his or her parent, one should not allow the child to define the relationship. Talk a little bit more about that and how you express that to your own patients.
Oh, well, I can tell you how I express it to the parents of my teenagers, because I think when you have teenagers that are in the throes of depression or hostility, and many of us who are parents of teenagers can recognize how that can happen, where at times you can seem like the stupidest person that could ever have been born, and there's the rolling of eyes or sucking of teeth or whatever, and that you really need to, as best you can, maintain a level of equanimity and allow both a sense that you are going to be present as loving as you can in this relationship, even when there can be a sense that you don't have a lot to contribute. And I just thought of this. When people are suicidal or really depressed, they think that they're expendable and that that they're a burden to people and that it won't make a difference if they're alive. And not to be too dramatic, but the experience sometimes of parenting a teenager can feel a little bit as if you really don't have much to offer and that your presence is really just a pain. And so it's that aspect when I work with parents and teenagers, is this sense that you're not going to give up, and that as long as everybody's alive, you can keep coming I'm not much of a baseball player, but coming to the, I can't remember the name of it, but the base, and trying to keep hitting the ball. I mean, that it's just around the act of engagement that's so important, and not retreating, and yet not being intrusive. So it's this careful balance.
And we could say that's something your father did with you when you were an adult.
Absolutely, and does to this day. He navigates with me.
And didn't allow you to abandon him in some way.
And that would have been a double tragedy of the suicide. And that's sometimes what happens in a suicide, is the impact on the family members is that it can divide you. And divide the family. And one of the unexpected gifts that I had from writing this memoir was reaching out to different people, reaching out to my stepmom, my brothers and sisters. And, you know, when you go back and revisit something that was painful growing up, you either can create a ruckus or sometimes it can be transformational. And I felt like being able to talk about with my brothers and sisters about something that we really hadn't dealt with that much together was huge.
You mentioned you're the mother of three children. How did they respond to, of course, now it sounds to me like they probably grew up with you working on this book.
You know, I often wonder about what it's like that you know, my mother's suicide is certainly, you know, I talk about silent grief, and then I think, well, that wasn't what happened in our family. We certainly lived not only with my, you know, the impact of my mother's suicide to me and how they might have thought about it. I know in one part of the book I talk about my daughter asking me, you know, would you ever kill yourself? But I wanted there to be, and I said no, just for the listener, but I wanted there to be an openness about how we try to come to terms with things in our life and hope that if I could be open about something that has been painful to me, that they too would feel permission to be able to be open about obstacles that they may come to. And that, you know, I don't want to sound self-praising, but there were times when I did have pressure not to tell this story. And I wanted them to know that if there are things in your life that are incredibly important for you to understand, that you keep the stamina and the momentum to explore what you need to do and not be apologetic about it and do the best that you can to tell a story that's compelling and meaningful to you.
Nancy Rappaport, thanks so much for talking with us. Your wonderful book is In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide.
It's an honor to be here today.
Go to writersvoice.net for a web-only clip from our interview in which Nancy Rappaport talks about the impact of divorce and custody battles on children and ways in which parents can help protect their children against those impacts. Next up, we'll hear an interview with Joan Wickersham that first aired in 2008 about her memoir of her father's suicide, The Suicide Index. It was a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 18 years ago, Joan Wickersham's father got up one morning from the bed he shared with his wife, walked into his study, and shot himself. He left no note. Why did he do it? How could he, a loving father and husband, subject his family to the anguish of dealing with losing him in such a violent manner? These unanswerable questions fueled Wickersham's search to reconcile the father she knew with a man who killed himself. As she wrote in her powerful 2008 memoir, The Suicide Index, "When you kill yourself, you kill every memory everyone has of you. You're saying, 'I'm gone,' and you can't even be sure who it is that's gone, because you never knew me." Wickersham tries to put her father's death in order through an ingenious narrative construction. Under headings about suicide like anger about, other people's stories about, possible ways to talk to a child about, Wickersham explores all the facets of coming to terms with her father's suicide. The Suicide Index was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2008. This interview originally aired that year. Your father killed himself in 1991. What was your first reaction to the news of his death?
Well, as I write in the book, I had a simultaneous reaction of that's impossible, he couldn't possibly have done that, that must not be true. And at the same time, my reaction was, oh my God, of course. And one of the I think, reasons I wanted to write about it was to try to figure out how could those two things be true at the same time. It was an instant paradox that I didn't feel that this was in his character. And at the same time, it felt like something I should have seen all along.
So why was it something you should have seen all along?
My father was a very private man, And that was a quality that I always actually admired in him. I think, you know, I saw it as a kind of self-reliance, a kind of dignity, a kind of containment. And I never saw it as a dangerous isolation. And I think that after he died, I suddenly looked at some of the things that had been going on in his life. He'd been having business problems. He had a loan from the bank that the bank had called the loan, and he couldn't come up with the money. He had had health problems for years. He had some things going on in his marriage with my mother. These were all things that when he was alive, he never really talked about them with me, but he hinted at them. And at the same time, he acted like, but I'm handling it. And I think after he died, I suddenly realized I should have viewed that, but I'm handling it, with much more skepticism than I did.
Now, you write this memoir, The Suicide Index, with a searing honesty. For example, you say on page 19, and I'm going to ask you to read just a short paragraph there, you talk about how you felt when you notified people of your father's death. And I know that when I read this, it took my breath away how willing you were to reveal, here it is, just the day or two after he had killed himself, what you were willing to reveal about yourself. Mm-hmm. So if you could start with the top of the page and just go down to that paragraph.
My husband came with me to make the phone calls. I let him do the talking, pulling people out of meetings. It's an emergency, he said. Yes, it is, I thought. And there was something of a relief in hearing him say it. This was not a debatable emergency, like calling the pediatrician on a Sunday morning when our son had a fever. This was emergency in its starkest, purest form. We had a perfect right to interrupt meetings, to shock people out of the ordinary progress of the day. I liked it that they came to the phone a little ruffled, a little worried, but unprepared for what my husband was about to tell them. I listened to him explaining over and over that my father was dead and how it had happened, and I felt a startling calm sense of power that was almost a thrill as my cousins and aunts and uncles went over the road that I had already traveled that morning. They were innocent. Then they were shocked and saddened. They were out on that rainy, windy road, but I was farther along than they.
The part that struck me was when you said that you had a calm sense of power that was almost a thrill. And I wondered about, when did you remember that? When did you know that you had that?
That's a fascinating question, I think, not just for this memory and this memoir, but for any memoir and any memoirist. I think that one of the reasons you choose to write a memoir is because you're really trying to recreate memories and how and when they're formed. And I think that that's something I felt at the time, that sense of, I think the sense of power was almost the reinforcement of this thing had happened that was so out of my realm of understanding that it sort of gained power as I drew more people into it. The more, you know, when it was just me who knew, it didn't seem real. But telling other people made it seem real over and over and over. And it was almost like forcing myself to wake up and forcing them to wake up and to acknowledge that something had happened. But I think that is the kind of thing that you feel in the moment, but you don't necessarily remember it right away. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the act of writing about it is part of how you start to form the recollection and form the memory. So it's not a question that I can answer precisely, but I think you put your finger on it, that it's part of what happens when you write a memoir, is that you remember things like that.
And what about the part of that that is the kind of stripping away of, I mean, this whole memoir is really about stripping away all kinds of layers, the superficial layers, to go more deeply. But then in a larger sense, that's what the memoirist does. And to reach that level of truth, the painstaking attention to the details of the truth, which is, this is just one example of, how does that happen? How does that get reconstructed?
Yeah, you know, for me, that was a product of writing it dishonestly more than once. You know, trying to write it as a novel, not that you could not, you know, you could have a very honest novel about suicide, but I wasn't able to write about this particular experience in fiction. And then I also tried to write it in memoir with a much wiser voice than I actually possess, you know, and I think that I had to let this be about questions that couldn't be answered, mysteries that couldn't be solved, paradoxes that couldn't be reconciled. And I think that there's a way that acknowledging the truth of the emotions had to do with acknowledging how complicated and messy they really were. And the only way I could do that was trying to make them neater and then realizing that's wrong. You know, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. I wrote this book so many times. I worked on this book for about 10 years on and off. And I wrote it so many times and it just didn't feel authentic. And I think finally, you know, there's kind of a moment where you write something and you kind of say, yes, that's it. That's what it was. But I only recognize those moments of truth by writing many moments of baloney.
Well, he died 17 years ago.
Yeah.
And so when was it that you realized that you were going to write a memoir?
I think I realized it pretty quickly. I mean, I think as a writer, when any big thing happens to you, you sort of realize you realize you're going to have to deal with the question of whether to write about it. You don't necessarily realize you are going to write about it. But I knew that this was a story I wanted to tell, and that I think, you know, suicide in itself is a story, because it's a death that when it happens, that question why is embedded in it. There's a mystery embedded in it. So I think the part of me that was his daughter was, you know, devastated and paralyzed. And the part of me that was a writer was also really looking at it with a great deal of curiosity at the same, you know, not quite at the same time, not, you know, but about 5 years after he died is when I started to really write about it. And, you know, I wrote about it in short stories. I thought I was going to write a novel. And then I sort of started to realize, no, it does need to be fragments. So the short story idea was kind of right, but it needs to be a more truthful kind of voice. And it needs to be a book.
We're talking with Joan Wickersham about her memoir, The Suicide Index. It's about her father's suicide. He killed himself with a gun in 1991. And I wanted to ask you about that, too. There was an awful lot of confusion, as is, I'm sure, always the case in cases of suicide, but even more so with him. There was even confusion about the method of that he used.
Yes, yeah. I mean, well, the first piece of confusion we had, you know, my father also did not leave a note. And I don't know any statistics about whether more people do or don't leave a note. But with him, he didn't leave a note. So we didn't really know. I didn't even know that he had a handgun. He had some rifles that I knew about. But he had killed himself with a handgun that he had hidden in his closet. And my mother, after his death, my mother remembered that he'd had that gun. But nobody had thought about it for years. So that was the first confusion. The second confusion had to do with, you know, because of the way he looked. When my mother found him, she thought that he had shot himself in the heart, and for some reason, she thought that this made it a more considerate gesture.
Because his face would not have been
right, but it turned out that he actually had shot himself. He put the gun in his mouth, which was something we didn't realize until much later, when my husband told me that the police had told him that. And, you know, again, I put that in the book because I felt like if you're going to write about this, you have to write about it honestly, and you have to really talk about the confusion and the mess and how different people have their version of what happened. And one of the things that I find sad, you know, among many things looking back at that, is that my mother still needed to construct a story for herself that somehow made him be considerate, even in the moment of killing himself in the house when she was asleep down the hall. And somehow she had to tell herself that he was this very considerate man, and he even killed himself in a considerate way, which of course is that sort of shock of ignoring the fact that he killed himself at all in a violent way in her house.
Well, you also made a lot of excuses for him.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the thing that is really hard about, one of the things that's very hard about suicide is everyone else gets really angry at the person who does it. So my friends were angry at my father. My relatives were angry at my father. You know, everybody who knew us, who had loved my father, respected my father, and continued to love and respect him, I think, after he died. But his suicide changed him, changed the way people thought about him. And that was one of the things I found unbearable, because I, you know, it changed the way I thought about him too. But in some way, I wanted him to still be the loved, trusted father that I knew. And this act that he had done turned him into somebody I felt I didn't know. So that was another one of the paradoxes I struggled with. And I think I was not as angry with my father as many of the people around us were. And I think it's because I felt like he'd already turned such appalling anger on himself,
How could I add to it? And I also felt like he was suffering. He was in pain, you know, and on the one hand, he left us by a very violent, you know, he had a very violent death. But on the other hand, you know, I loved him. And if I could have gotten him back, I would have put my arms around him and said, don't do it. You know, and maybe he would have, and maybe he wouldn't have.
But in some sense, did that rob you of something?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, my mother died very recently, and one of the things I found with her death, as sad as it is, and as much as I miss her, and I'm going to miss her, there's a way that, you know, we got a chance to say I love you, we got a chance to say goodbye, and I miss her, and I know who it is I'm missing. You know, my memories of my mother are intact. You know, she died at the end of a long, long life of an illness, and that's, you know, I'm not saying that that's an easy thing, but there's a way that with my it clarified for me what I've written about in this book, that, you know, when someone dies by suicide, you lose a lot of your memories of that person because you lose your sense of who that person was. You lose your confidence that you knew that person as well as you think you did. It's a double loss that you lose. When my father died, I lost him and I lost my sense of who he was. When my mother died, I lost my mother.
You alluded to already to some of the problems that he was facing, some of the reasons why he might have killed himself. But even here, it was a long time kind of parsing the fragments of knowledge. You write that it was as if someone said, I knew he had matches, but I didn't think he'd light them. And another person saying, I knew he lived in a house of paper, but I didn't know he had matches. What were some of the pieces of this? Mm-hmm. A story that he had.
Yeah, I mean, some of it, and again, I go through this in the book. The way the book is structured, the first part of the book is really talking about the events of his death, and then I get to a point where I realize I have to go back into the past, and it's not even necessarily. There are memoirs where people go back and do a lot of research into their family and really reconstruct the details of their family history, and that's not what I'm really doing here. I'm doing more. What are the memories? What did my father tell me? What did my father not tell me? What do I know about his childhood? What can I speculate about what his childhood was like based on what he told me? And he was the son of two dancers. His mother was German and his father was Russian. And they came over here a couple of years before. They came over in 1936 and sent for him in 1939. So he was born in Germany. He was 10 years old when he came here. And his father was brutal to him and beat him to the point of broken bones, which is something I didn't know until after he died. So that was one of the factors that, you know, that this brutal childhood with great extremes of rich and poor and parents who were artists, and he really rebelled against that. He just thought that there was something irresponsible about artists and that you needed to be a businessman, and he was absolutely unsuited to be a businessman. He just didn't have the right temperament, but that was his ambition, and that's what he wanted to do. So by the time he died, he had a history of business failures. So that was one thing. The second thing was, as I said, that he had taken out this bank loan for one of the businesses that he was working on. The bank had called the loan, and he felt he couldn't pay it back, and he also felt he couldn't tell my mother about this loan. One of the things that was very sad after he died was we found out the amount of the loan, and it was, you know, it was not tiny. It was $55,000, but it's the kind of thing where if everybody in the family and, you know, everybody had pitched in, we could have bailed him out. But he clearly didn't. He felt, I think, disgraced and in despair and, you know, whatever. He had chronic health problems, nothing life-threatening. But again, I think it may have worn down on him. And I think that really the big unspoken thing with my father, I think, was depression. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something he would have considered a weakness and a failing. He wouldn't have thought of it as an illness the way we do now. And he wouldn't have, I don't think he ever would have gone for therapy, and I don't think he ever would have gone for medication, even if the medication had been available back then that is now.
You struggle with the whole question of him as a success and failure. And as you know, you show there are many ways in which he could have felt that he was a failure. How was he a success?
Well, I mean, this is the thing that was so painful after he died is he was a wonderful father. He was a tolerant man that you could tell him anything. He was not judgmental. I put in the book, there was a time when my husband didn't get into the graduate school he really wanted to go to. And so my father took the day off from work, drove to the town where we were living, took my husband out for the day. They went for a long walk in the woods. My husband talked about how hurt and disappointed he was. And my father just listened. I mean, he was just a very patient, kind person. He was a wonderful grandfather to my son. You know, he read poetry to us. He had fun with us. I mean, he would come home at the end of the day and hang out with us. I mean, he was a lovely, lovely man, very funny, very thoughtful, very, very kind, very caring. And yet I realized after he died that I think he could do that for us, but he couldn't do it for himself. I think he was much, much harder on himself than he was on anybody else. And I think, you know, again, I think that goes back to probably a undiagnosed serious depression.
What you're really describing here is the whole confused welter of emotions that come about. And there's a certain point where you go into therapy.
Yes.
And you're in your psychiatrist's office and you're talking about how there are two types of men in the world. You know, they're either really kind men and they're killers. And you said how your father was a really kind man, and then your therapist said, until he became a killer.
Yeah, exactly. And I put that in the book because that was one of those moments. It was 9 years after my father's death that I had that moment with my therapist, and that was one of the moments where I woke up, and I just said, yes, you know, he did. I have to acknowledge now that he's not here because he took this action. And I think it was so hard for me. I wanted to blame somebody else. I wanted to find some other explanation. At one point, I write in the book that maybe somebody broke into our house and murdered him. I mean, it was easier for me to imagine that that had happened than it was to accept the fact that my father had done this. And I think that it, you know, it took a lot of years before I was ready to look at that. And it took, I think, in therapy, you know, just getting to trust the doctor enough so that when he said, you know, your father was a killer, he killed himself, I was ready to hear that. People ask me all the time, you know, do you heal from something like this? And do you, and I think what you get to is you get to an acceptance. For me, I got to an acceptance that this is what happened and that I don't need anymore to reconcile. For a long time, it was, how could my father have done this if he loved me? And then given that my father did this, maybe he didn't love me. And I sort of feel like, no, he did love me and he did do this. And I think sort of being able to hold all those contradictory things in your head at once, that's what the healing is. And that's maybe where the acceptance comes from, you know, that you don't ever get over it. You don't ever say, it's okay that this happened. I'm fine with it. But you sort of, for me, it was getting to the point where I really turned all these things over in the book. I can hold them all in my head at once and just accept that they're all true. It's not either this or that. It's all of it.
And we're talking with Joan Wickersham about her wonderful memoir, powerful memoir, The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order. You also had a pretty complicated relationship to your mother, although more on the kind of ordinary run of things, because as you say, she had a normal death. You talk about it as being love compounded by anger.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to read that part? It's on page 86.
Yeah, this is from a part of the book. One of the things I do in the book is talk about factors that may or may not have had an influence on my father's death. And again, this is part of my looking around for someone else to blame because I couldn't bear the idea of blaming him. And I also go on in the book to sort of say that I recognize that that's what I was doing, you know, that I was being very hard on the people around me for a while because I just so wanted it not to fall at his feet. I wanted it to be someone else's fault. Which I think is typical after a suicide, that people point fingers at each other. I never pointed fingers explicitly, but in my head, I was pointing a lot of fingers. So this is at the end of a section where I'm talking about my mother and some of the things in their marriage that, you know, bothered me to see and I think may have bothered my father. But also the loyalty that you feel to, you know, I felt very protective of my mother as well. So I said, I don't know. What I know is she's my mother. My love for her has very little to do with liking. It's a fierce, dumb love. It's a love compounded of anger for all the things she could never see and desire to protect her from ever seeing them.
Could you talk a little bit more about that, especially that last sentence? I'm asking you because I think it's probably familiar to many people in relationship to their parents. I have a sense my son probably feels some of that toward me, and I know I feel some of that toward my mother. Maybe it's inevitable in relationships with people that you love, but say more about it.
Yeah, I think it's about what are the things that get said in a family and what are the things that don't get said. And I think one thing that's true in my family, which I imagine it's true in a lot of families, is that our manners with each other are not as good as our manners with our friends and or with the general public. And so my mother and I had a relationship that was very, it was very close and very loving, but very prickly. And there was a lot of criticism flung in both directions. And I think that, that struggle between you want justice to be done, you want the divine referee to be looking and saying that point goes to you, and no, that one, I'm sorry, but you were wrong on that one. And there is no referee. And that's part of what, again, with this book, you know, it's called The Suicide Index. It's about my father's suicide, but it's also about family relationships and what, you know, an event happened in my family that was a huge event that put pressure on all the pressure points that were already there in the family. And I think that's what that paragraph comes out of, is that idea that somehow I want my mother to get it. You know, I want her to see the truth, whatever it is, but I also don't want to hurt her. I don't want to, you know, and that was one of the things I grappled with also writing a memoir. I think that's something that anybody who writes a family memoir grapples with, is basically, you know, what are people going to feel about you're putting your version out there. What are people going to feel about it? How are people going to react? They have their own version, which, you know, accords with you on some things and is going to be really different on some things. And I think that was something I thought about a lot. You know, in the 10 years it took me to write this book, I really, part of me wanted to be done and have it published, and another part of me wanted it to go on for another 30 years. So that
until they were dead.
Until they were dead, yeah. One of the best memoirs I've ever read is, it's by a writer named Ellen Douglas, and the title of it is Truth, and the subtitle is Four Stories I'm Finally Old Enough to Tell. And I think that's what she meant, that, you know, the people that could have been affected by those stories were gone.
So your mother was alive.
Yes.
Did she read this book?
She had someone read it to her at the point that it came out. It came out this summer, and by that point she couldn't really see very well. But she had someone read it to her. I said to her, you know, maybe it's too painful. Maybe you don't want to read it. I'm not sure. She wanted to read it. She wanted to know what was in it. And she said to me, you know, she said, I think you've done a really important thing here, and I understand why you needed to tell the story. So she was actually very loving and very graceful about it. It was extraordinary.
So finally, do you think that it's wrong to commit suicide?
Well, you know, that's another question that I wrestle with in the book, because I think what the real underlying question to that is whether suicide is a choice. You know, whether it's, is it a rational choice that my father made to do this, in which case I think it's wrong, or is it some kind of, you know, irrational explosion of an illness that he had no control over, in which case how can you even talk about right or wrong connected with that? And so I don't know the answer. I mean, all I can say is the impact on other people of a suicide is enormous and terrible and permanent. But I also think I wrestle with that question of it's never right. But if there's how do I put this? Philosophers, I think, have wrestled for thousands of years with that question of, is this a rational choice or not? And that's what I think is really the question, rather than right or wrong, is this, are you seized by something beyond your control, or do you actually have a choice? And there's one part in the book that, two little sections called Philosophical Conundrums, and one of them is basically, did he have a choice? And if he did, then how can we forgive him? And if he didn't, then how can we blame him?
Joan Wickersham talking about her memoir, The Suicide Index, with Writer's Voice in 2008. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.